11. Due to the exorbitant cost of maintaining two residences in separate states, many first-year congressional representatives are forced to rent overpriced apartments, a large number of them located in leaky, unventilated basements, or share rented townhouses or condos with multiple roommates. Most do so without complaint. The hours are long, and they rarely find themselves at home anyway, except to shower and sleep, or, if they're lucky, eat the occasional unrushed meal. Gwendy Peterson suffers from no such financial dilemma, thanks to the success of her novels and the resulting movie adaptations, and lives alone in a three-story townhouse located two blocks east of the Capitol building. Nevertheless, on a near-daily basis, she feels no small amount of guilt because of her living situation and is always quick to offer a spare bedroom should anyone need a place to stay. Tonight, however, as she sits in the middle of her sofa with her legs curled beneath her, picking at a carton of shrimp lo mein and staring blindly at the television, she is over the moon grateful for her solo living arrangements and even more appreciative that she has no overnight guests. The button box sits on the sofa next to her, looking out of place, almost like a child's toy in the sterile environment of the townhouse. It took Gwendy the better part of the afternoon to figure out how to smuggle the box out of her office. After several failed attempts, she finally settled on dumping her new boots onto the floor of the closet and using the large cardboard box they came in to conceal it under her arm. Fortunately, the security checkpoints set up through the building were put in place for arriving personnel only and not for those departing. A commercial for the new Tom Hanks movie blares on the television, but Gwendy doesn't notice. She hasn't moved from the sofa in the past 2 hours, except to answer the door when the delivery man rang the bell. Dozens of questions sift through her mind, one after the other in rapid-fire succession, with a dozen more waiting in the shadows to take their place. Two questions reoccur most frequently as if on a continuous loop. Why is the box back? And why now? Gwendy has never told a soul about the button box. Not her husband, not her parents, not even Jonathan or the therapist she saw twice a week for 6 months back in her mid-20s. There was a time when the box filled her every waking thought, when she was obsessed with the mystery and the power contained within. But that was a lifetime ago. Now, for the most part, her memories of the box feel like scattered remnants of a recurring dream she once had during childhood, but whose details have long since been lost in the never-ending maze of adulthood. There's a lot of truth to the old adage, out of sight, out of mind. She has, of course, thought about the box in the 15 years since it vanished from her life, and she's just come to terms with this revelation in the last 60 minutes or so, not nearly as much as she probably should have, considering the immense role the button box played for much of her adolescence. Looking back, there were weeks, perhaps even months, when it never once crossed her mind, and then boom, she would watch a news report about a mysterious, seemingly natural disaster that occurred in some faraway state or country, and she would immediately picture someone sitting in a car or at a kitchen table with their finger resting on a shiny red button. Or she would stumble upon a news teaser online about a man discovering buried treasure in the backyard of his suburban home and would click the link to see if any 1891 Morgan silver dollars were involved. There were also those dark instances, thankfully rare, when she would catch a glimpse of old grainy video footage on television or hear a snippet of radio discussion about the Jonestown massacre in Guyana. When that happened, her heart would skip a beat and set to aching, and she would tumble into a deep black hole of depression for days. And finally, there were those times when she would spot a neat black bowler's hat bobbing up and down amidst a crowd on a busy sidewalk, or glance over at an outdoor cafe table and spy the shiny dome of that black hat resting next to a mug of steaming coffee or a frosty glass of iced tea. And of course, her thoughts would rush back to the man in the black coat. She thought about Richard Ferris and that hat of his more than all the rest of it. It was always the mysterious Mr. Ferris that swam closest to the surface of her conscious mind. It was his voice she'd heard back in her office, and it is his voice she hears again now as she sits on the sofa with her bare legs tucked beneath her. "Take care of the box, Gwendy. It gives gifts, but there's small recompense for the responsibility. And be careful." 13. And what about those gifts the box so willingly dispenses? Although she didn't actually witness the narrow wooden shelf slide out from the center of the box with a silver dollar on it, she believes that's where the coin on her desk came from. Coin box, box coin. It all made perfect sense. Does that mean pulling the other lever, the one on the left side by the red button she remembers as if it were yesterday, will deliver a tiny chocolate treat? Maybe, and maybe not. You can never tell with the button box. She believed it had a lot more tricks up its sleeve 15 years ago, and she believes it even more now. She brushes her fingertip against the small lever, thinking about the animal-shaped chocolates, no two ever the same, each exotically sweet and no bigger than a jelly bean. She remembers the first time she ever laid eyes on one of those chocolates, standing next to Richard Ferris in front of the park bench. It was in the shape of a rabbit, and the degree of detail was astounding. The fur, the ears, the cute little eyes. After that, there was a kitty, and a squirrel, and a giraffe. Her memory grows hazy then, but she remembers enough. Eat one chocolate, and you were never hungry for seconds. Eat a bunch of chocolates over a period of time, and you changed. You got faster, and stronger, and smarter. You had more energy, and always seemed to be on the winning side of a coin flip or a board game. The chocolates also improved your eyesight and erased your acne, or had puberty taken care of that last one? Sometimes it was hard to tell. Gwendy looks down and is horrified to see that her finger has strayed from the small lever on the side of the box to the row of colored buttons. She jerks her hand back as if it's wrist deep in a hornet's nest. But it's too late, and the voice comes again. Light green, Asia. Dark green, Africa. Orange, Europe. Yellow, Australia. Blue, North America. Violet, South America. And the red one? Gwendy asks aloud. Whatever you want, the voice answers. And you will want it. The owner of the box always does. She gives her head a shake, trying to silence the voice, but it isn't finished yet. Buttons are hard to push, Ferris tells her. You have to use your thumb and put some real muscle into it, which is a good thing, believe me. Wouldn't want to make any mistakes with those, oh no, especially not with the black one. The black one. Back then she called it the cancer button. She shudders at the memory. The phone rings, and for a second time today, Gwendy almost faints. 14. Ryan, I'm so glad you called. I've been trying to get up for days, sweetheart, he says, his voice momentarily gone amidst a blast of static. Stupid phones here are worthless. Here is the small island of Timor, located off the southern end of Southeast Asia. Ryan's been there since the first week of December with a Time magazine crew covering government unrest. Are you okay? Gwendy asks. Are you safe? I stink like I've been living barn the last couple of weeks, but I'm fine. Gwendy laughs. Happy tears stream down her cheeks. She gets up from the sofa and starts pacing back and forth. Are you going to make it home in time for Christmas? I don't know, honey. I hope so, but are heating up here. I understand, Gwendy nods her head. I hope you're wrong, but I understand. How's doing, he says, cutting out again. What? I didn't hear you, baby. How's your mom doing? Gwendy smiles, and then stops in her tracks. She stares at the curtain window that occupies the upper half of the kitchen door, unsure if it's her imagination. A few seconds pass, and she's just about convinced she's seeing things, when a shadow moves again. Someone's outside on the deck. Hear me? Ryan says, startling her. Oh, she's doing fine, Gwendy says, inching into the kitchen and pulling open a drawer. gaining weight and going to her appointments. She takes out a steak knife and holds it against her leg. I'll have to make her secret recipe pancakes when I'm home. Just get your butt home in one piece, will you? He laughs and starts to say something else, and then there's an ear-piercing jolt of static and dead air. Hello? Hello? She says, pulling the phone away from her ear so she can look at the screen. Shit, he's gone. Gwendy places the cell phone on the counter, crouches, and edges closer to the door. When she reaches the end of the row of cabinets, she crab walks the last couple of feet into position directly behind the door. Before she can lose her nerve, she lets out a banshee cry and springs to her feet, flipping on the outside light with one hand and using the other hand to flick aside the flowered curtains with the tip of the steak knife. Whoever was standing outside of the door is gone. All that's left is her wide-eyed reflection staring back at her. 15. The first thing Gwendy does after retrieving her cell phone from the kitchen counter, even before she walks to the front door and double-checks the deadbolt, is to make sure nothing has happened to the button box. For one terrible, breathless moment, while she's crossing from the kitchen into the family room, she imagines that the figure at the back door was a diversionary tactic, and while she was busy conducting her counterattack, an accomplice was breaking into the front of the house and stealing away with the box. Her entire body sags with relief when she sees the button box sitting on the sofa right where she'd left it. A short time later, as she makes her way upstairs carrying the box, it occurs to her that she never once considered telling Ryan about it. At first, she tries to use the severed connection as an excuse, but she knows better. The button box came back to her, and only her. Nobody else. It's mine, she says as she enters the bedroom, and shivers at the intensity of her voice. 16. Gwendy sleepwalks her way through December 17th, 1999, her final day at the office before Congress begins its three-week holiday break. She spends the first 15 minutes convincing Bea that she feels well enough to be at work. The day before, the panicked receptionist was ready to call the paramedics when she found Gwendy vomiting in her trash can. Luckily, Gwendy was able to convince her that it must have been something bad she ate for breakfast, and after agreeing to go home 40 minutes early, the older woman finally relented, and the next 8.5 hours resisting the urge to rush home and check on the button box. She hated to leave the box back at the townhouse, especially after the scare at her kitchen door the night before, but she didn't have much of a choice. No telling how the x-ray machines at the security checkpoints would react to the box, and perhaps even more worrisome, no telling how the box would react to being x-rayed. Gwendy didn't have a clue what the inside of the button box looked like or what its innards were made of, but she wasn't taking any chances. Before she left for her two-block walk to the Capitol building, she hid the box at the back of a narrow crawl space underneath the staircase. She stacked cardboard boxes full of books on each side and in front of it, and laid a pile of winter coats on top of it all. Once she was satisfied, she closed the crawl space's small door, locked up the townhouse, and started for work. She managed only to return home to check on the box twice before finally making it into the office. Gwendy's last day passes in a blur of faceless voices and background noise. Several phone conferences in the morning and a pair of brief committee meetings in the afternoon. She doesn't remember much of what was said in any of them, or even what she ate for lunch. When 5 o'clock rolls around, she locks her office and sets off to deliver Christmas gifts to a handful of co-workers. A set of scented candles and bath salts for Patsy, a cashmere sweater and bracelet for Bea, and a stack of signed books for Bea's children. After well wishes and hugs goodbye, she heads for the lobby. 17.
I'm sure gonna miss your smiling face these next few weeks, Congresswoman.
I'm gonna miss you too, Gwendy says, stopping at the security desk. She reaches into her tote bag and pulls out a small box covered in snowman wrapping paper. She hands it across the barrier to the barrel-chested guard. Merry Christmas, Harold.
Harold's mouth drops open. He slowly reaches out and takes the gift. You got me. This is really for me?
Gwendy smiles and nods her head.
Of course. I would never forget my favorite head of security. He looks at her in confusion.
Head of...
And then he grins, and those gold teeth of his wink at her in the fluorescent lights.
Oh, you're joking with me.
Open your present, silly man. His meaty fingers attack the wrapping paper and uncover a shiny black box with Balova printed in gold lettering across the top of it. He opens the box and looks up in disbelief.
You bought me a watch?
I saw you admiring Congressman Anderson's last week, Gwendy says. I thought you deserved one of your own. Harold opens his mouth, but no words come out. Gwendy is surprised to see that the guard's eyes have gone shiny and his chin is trembling.
This is the nicest present anyone has ever given me, he finally says. Thank you.
For the first time today, Gwendy feels like maybe everything will be okay. You're very welcome, Harold. I hope you and your family have a wonderful Christmas. She pats his arm affectionately and turns to leave.
Not so fast, Harold says, raising a hand.
He ducks behind the desk and comes back up with a wrapped gift of his own. He hands it to Gwendy. She looks at him in surprise and then reads the gift tag. To Congresswoman Gwendy Peterson from Harold and Beth. Thank you, she says, genuinely touched. Both of you. She opens the present. It's a thick hardcover book with a bright orange dust jacket. She turns it over so she can see the front cover. And the room shifts up, down, and up again, like she just sat down on a teeter-totter at the playground.
You okay, Congresswoman? Harold asks. You already have a copy?
No, Gwendy says, holding up the book. I've never read it, but I've always wanted to.
Oh, good, he says, relieved. I can barely make heads or tails of the jacket copy, but my wife read it and said it was fascinating.
Gwendy forces a smile on her face. Thank you again, Harold. It really is a lovely surprise.
Thank you again, Congresswoman Peterson. You shouldn't have, but I'm sure glad you did, he bursts out laughing.
Gwendy slips the book inside her leather tote and heads for the elevator. On the ride down, she takes another peek at the cover, just to make sure she's not losing her mind. She's not. The book Harold gave her is Gravity's Rainbow. It's the same novel Richard Ferris was reading on the bench in Castle View 25 years earlier, on the day he first gave Gwendy the button box. 18. Gwendy is leaning toward canceling her long-scheduled dinner plans with friends even before the copy of Gravity's Rainbow shows up. But Harold's well-meaning but not-so-pleasant surprise cinches the deal. She goes straight home, unburies the button box from its hiding place, changes into sweatpants and a baggy sweater, and calls out for delivery. While her friends, two former classmates from Brown, dine on filet mignon and grilled vegetables at historic Old Ebbett Grill on 15th, where you have to call weeks in advance for a table, Gwendy sits alone in her dining room, picking at the sorriest excuse for a garden salad she's ever seen and nibbling on a slice of pizza. She's not really alone, of course. The button box is there, resting on the opposite end of the table, watching her eat like a silent suitor. A few minutes earlier, she looked up from her dinner and asked quite sincerely, "Okay, you're back. What do I do with you now?" The box didn't answer. Gwendy's attention is currently focused on an evening news program playing on the Den television, and she's not happy. She still can't believe Clinton lost this idiot. "The President of the United States is a flipping moron," she says, stuffing a piece of lettuce that's closer to brown than it is green into her mouth. "You tell him, Bernie." Anchorman Bernard Shaw, with his distinguished salt-and-pepper hair and thick mustache, does just that. "Recap the sequence of events that has brought us to this potentially catastrophic standoff. Initially, spy satellite photographs led U.S. officials to suspect that North Korea was developing a new nuclear facility near the Yongbyon Nuclear Center that was originally disabled by the 1994 Accord. Based on these photographs, Washington demanded an inspection of the facility, and Pyongyang countered by demanding the U.S. pay $300 million for the right to inspect the site. Earlier this week, President Hanlon responded angrily, and many say disrespectfully, in public comments directed at the North Korean leader, refusing to pay any such inspection fee and calling the proposal ludicrous and laughable. Now, within the past hour, Pyongyang has released a written statement referring to President Hanlon as a brainwashed bully and threatening to pull out of the 1994 Accord. No response from the White House yet, but one unnamed official claims, "That's just great," Gwendy says, getting up from the table and tossing the remains of her salad into the trash. "A pissing contest between two egomaniacs. I'm going to get a lot of calls over this." 19. Gwendy pulls the blanket over her chest and gives the box one last look before turning off the bedside lamp. Earlier in the evening, after brushing her teeth and washing her face, she placed the button box on the dresser next to her jewelry tray and hairbrushes. Now she's wondering if she should move it closer, just to be safe. She reaches out to turn on the light again, but freezes when she hears the creak of a door opening on hinges that need oiling. She immediately recognizes the sound. It's her closet door. Unable to move, she watches in terror as a dark figure emerges from inside the walk-in closet. She tries to bark out a warning. "Stop! I have a gun! I'm calling 911. Anything that might buy her a little more time, but realizes that she's holding her breath. Suddenly remembering the button box on the dresser, she yanks off the thick blanket and scrambles across the bed, but the intruder is too fast. He lunges at her, strong arms grabbing her around the waist and wrestling her back onto the bed. She screams and flails at her attacker, clawing at his eyes, ripping off the ski mask he's wearing. Gwendy sees his face in the glow of the television and gasps. The intruder is Frankie Stone, somehow alive again and looking exactly as he did almost 20 years earlier on the night he killed her boyfriend, baggy camo pants, dark glasses, and a tight t-shirt, wearing that stupid grin of his, greasy brown hair staining his shoulders, shotgun pattern of acne scattered across his cheeks. He flips over and pins Gwendy against the mattress, and she can smell the stale, alcohol-tainted foulness of his breath as he hisses. "Give me the box, you dumb bitch. Give it to me right now or I'll eat you alive." And then his jaws yawn open impossibly wide, and the world goes dark as Frankie Stone closes his mouth and engulfs her. 20. Gwendy jerks upright in bed, clutching a tangle of sweat-soaked sheets to her chest and gasping for breath. Her eyes dart to the closet door across the room. It's closed tight. And then to her dresser. The button box is exactly as she left it, sitting there in the dark with its watchful gaze. 21.
"You sure you don't want me to stow your bag, Congresswoman Peterson?"
Gwendy looks at the co-pilot, who had introduced himself just minutes earlier when she first boarded the 8-seat private plane, but she's already forgotten his name. "No, it's fine. I packed my laptop and I'll probably fiddle around with some work once we're in the air."
"Very well," he says. "We should be taking off in about 20 minutes.
He gives her a reassuring smile, the kind that says, "Your life is in my hands, lady, but I slept great last night and only did a little bump of cocaine this morning, so hey, it's all good," and ducks back into the cockpit. Gwendy yawns and looks out the window at the busy runway. The last thing she wants to do during the short flight is fiddle with her laptop. She's exhausted from not sleeping the night before and in a foul mood. Not even 48 hours have passed since the button box has returned to her life, and she's already moved on from shock and curiosity to anger and resentment. She glances at her carry-on suitcase, tucked underneath the seat in front of her, and fights the urge to check on the box again. Squeezing her eyes shut, she tries to silence the obsessive voice chattering away in the back of her head, and abruptly snaps them open again when she realizes she's dozing off. Sleeping with the box unsecured might not be such a smart idea, she decides. "Is it safe?" she suddenly asks out loud without intending to.
She looks down at the suitcase again. The flight is less than 90 minutes long. What's the worst that can happen if she takes a little cat nap? She doesn't know, and she's not willing to find out. She can sleep when she gets home. Is it safe? She's thinking of the old Dustin Hoffman movie now, with the evil Nazi dentist. Is it safe? When it comes to the button box, Gwendy knows the answer to that question. The box is never safe. Not really.
We're number two for takeoff, Congresswoman, the co-pilot says, peeking out from the cockpit. We should have you on the ground in Castle Rock a few minutes before noon.
22. If Gwendy's being honest with herself, and as the King Air 200 climbs high in the clouds above a muddy twist of Potomac River, she's determined to be exactly that, she has to admit that her crummy mood this morning is coming from one overwhelming source, a long-forgotten memory from her youth. It was a mild and breezy August day shortly before the start of her 10th grade year in high school, and Gwendy just finished running the suicide stairs for the first time in months. When she reached the top, she sat and rested on the same Castle View bench where years earlier she'd first met a man named Richard Ferris. She stretched her legs for a moment, and then she leaned her head back and closed her eyes, enjoying the feeling of the sun and the wind on her face. The question that had bloomed in her mind while sitting on the bench that long ago summer day resurfaced, and rather rudely, earlier this morning as Gwendy was busy cushioning the button box in her carry-on bag with rolled-up wads of socks and sweaters. How much of her life is her own doing, and how much the doing of the box with its treats and buttons? The memory, and the central thought contained within that memory, was almost enough to make Gwendy scream in rage and fling the box across the bedroom like a toddler in the midst of a temper tantrum. No matter how she looks at it, Gwendy knows she's led what most people would call a charmed life. There was the scholarship to Brown, the writer's workshop in Iowa, the fast-track job at the ad agency, and of course, the books and movies and Academy Award. And then there was the election, what many pundits called the biggest political upset in Maine history. Sure, there were failures along the way, a lost advertising account here, a film option that didn't pan out there, and her love life before Ryan could probably best be described as a barren desert of disappointment. But there weren't too many, and she always bounced back with an ease of which others were envious. Even now, glaring at the button box resting securely between her feet, Gwendy believes with all her heart that the bulk of her success can be attributed to hard work and a positive attitude, not to mention thick skin and persistence. But what if what she believes to be true simply isn't? 23. A light snow is falling from a low-hanging, slate-gray sky when Gwendy lands at the Castle County Airport out on Route 39. Nothing heavy, just a kiss on the cheek from the north that will leave yards and roadways coated with an inch or so of slush by dinner time. She called ahead before boarding the plane and asked Billy Finkelstein, one of only two full-timers at Castle County Airport, to jump her car battery back to life and pull her Subaru hatchback out of one of the three narrow hangars that run alongside the wooded shoulder of Route 39. Billy is true to his word, and the car's waiting for her in the parking lot, both the engine and heater running hard. She thanks Billy, sliding him a tip even though it's against the rules, and nods hello to his boss, Jesse Martin, one of her father's old bowling partners. She loads her carry-on into the front passenger seat and tosses her tote bag on top of it. On her way home, Gwendy makes a pair of quick phone calls. The first is to her father, to let him know she landed safely and that she'll be there for dinner tonight. Mom's asleep on the sofa, so she doesn't get to speak to her, but Dad's pleased as punch and looking forward to seeing Gwendy later. The second call is to Castle County Sheriff Norris Ridgewick's cell phone. It rings straight to voicemail, so she leaves a message after the beep. "Hey, Norris, it's Gwendy Peterson. I just got back into town and figured we ought to touch base. Give me a buzz when you can." As she presses the end button on her phone, Gwendy feels the Subaru's back tires momentarily loosen their grip on the road. She carefully steers back into the center of the lane and drops her speed. That's all you need, she thinks. Hit a telephone pole, knock yourself unconscious, and have the button box discovered by some 19-year-old snowplow driver with a tin of Red Man in his back pocket and frozen snot crusted on his lip. 24. There are only two ways up to Castle View in 1999. Route 117 and Pleasant Road. Gwendy steers the Subaru onto Pleasant, climbing past a winding half-mile stretch of single homes, ranchers, Cape Cods, and saltbox colonials, many of them decorated for Christmas, and takes a left after the new American Legion playground onto View Drive. She drives another couple hundred yards, and then makes a right into the snow-covered parking lot of Castle View Condominiums. Several years ago, she and Ryan were among the first half-dozen folks to purchase a unit in the newly built complex. Despite their busy travel schedules, they've been happy there ever since. Gwendy swings into a reserved spot in the front row and turns off the engine. Circling to the passenger side to pull out her suitcase, she glances down a series of gently sloping hills to a fenced-off precipice where she once ran a zigzagging metal staircase called the Suicide Stairs. Standing out like a dark scar on the snowy hillside is the wooden bench where she first met the stranger in the black hat. Gwendy punches in a 4-digit security code to gain entrance to her building and climbs the stairs to the second floor. Once inside Unit 19B, she shrugs off her jacket, leaving it on the foyer floor, unzips her suitcase, and takes out the button box, carries it down the hallway to the bedroom, places it on her husband's side of the bed, and curls up next to it. 30 seconds later, she's snoring. 25. Gwendy opens her eyes to the dark silence of her bedroom, disoriented by the lack of daylight at the window, and momentarily forgets where she is. She hustles into the bathroom to pee and experiences a sharp spike of panic in her chest when she remembers dinner with her parents. After stashing the button box inside a fireproof safe in the office she shares with Ryan, she spends the next 5 minutes searching for her keys. She finally finds them in the pocket of her jacket on the floor and rushes out the door, determined not to be late. Driving faster than she should on the slick roads, she's a block away from her parents' house when she thinks about the box again. "It should be safe in the safe," she says out loud and laughs. The safe was originally her husband's idea. Convinced that they both needed a place to store their valuables, he supervised the purchase and installation of the Sentry safe a few months after they moved into the condo. Of course, several years later, there was nothing inside the thing except for a handful of contracts, old insurance papers, an envelope containing a small amount of cash, and a signed Ted Williams baseball inside a plastic cube, and now the button box. "I can't keep lugging it around with me everywhere I go," Gwendy thinks, turning onto Carbine Street. "Can't keep it in the condo either, not when Ryan gets back." She'd stored the button box in a safe deposit box at the Bank of Rhode Island during her 4 years at Brown, and that worked out just fine. Maybe she'd drop by Castle Rock's savings and loan at the beginning of the week, see what they have available. Gwendy spots her parents' Cape Cod ahead in the distance and breaks into a smile. Her father has really outdone himself this year. Green and red and blue Christmas bulbs outline the gutters of the roof and spiral up and down the front porch railings. A huge inflatable Santa Claus, illuminated by a series of bright spotlights, dances in the breeze at the center of the front yard. An inflatable red-nosed reindeer grazes in the snow at Santa's feet. "He did all this for Mom," Gwendy realizes, pulling into the driveway and parking behind her father's truck. Still smiling, she gets out and walks to the door. She's home again. 26. Mr. Peterson is preparing chicken and dumplings for dinner, Gwendy's favorite, and the three of them catch up on everything, from the two missing girls to across-the-street neighbor Betty Johnson's sudden conversion to bleach blonde, to the New England Patriots' 3-game losing streak. Mrs. Peterson, looking better than Gwendy has seen her look in months, complains about still needing to take daily naps,
and her husband's constant coddling. But she does so with a grateful smile and an affectionate squeeze of Mr. Peterson's forearm. She's wearing a different wig tonight, a shade darker and a couple inches longer than the one she was wearing the last time Gwendy was home. And it not only makes her look healthier, it makes her appear years younger. Her face lights up when Gwendy tells her so.
"Any more news from Ryan?" Mrs. Peterson asks, as her husband gets up and goes into the kitchen to silence the oven timer.
"Not since he called 2 nights ago, Gwendy says.
"You still think he'll make it home in time for Christmas?"
Gwendy shakes her head.
"I don't know, Mom. It all depends on what happens over there.
I've been keeping an eye on the news, but they haven't reported much yet." Mr. Peterson walks into the dining room, carrying a plate stacked high with biscuits.
"Saw President Hamlin on the tube earlier this evening. I still can't believe our Gwendy gets to work with the commander-in-chief."
Mrs. Peterson gives her daughter a smile and rolls her eyes. She's heard this spiel before, many times, they both have.
"Have you spoken with him lately?" he asks eagerly.
"A bunch of us were in a meeting with him and the vice president last week," Gwendy says. Her father beams with pride. "Trust me, it's not all it's cracked up to be." As is often the case, she's tempted to tell her father the reality of the situation, that President Hamlin is a sexist bore of a man who rarely looks Gwendy in the eyes, instead focusing on her legs if she's wearing a dress or her chest if she's wearing pants, that she purposefully never stands too close to the commander-in-chief because of his tendency to touch her on the arms and shoulders when he speaks to her. She's also tempted to tell him that the president's as dumb as a donut and has horrible breath, but she doesn't say any of these things, not to her father anyway. Now, her mother is a different story.
"I liked what he said about North Korea," Mr. Peterson says. "We need a strong leader to deal with that madman."
"He's acting more like a petulant child right now than a leader." Her father gives her a thoughtful look.
"You really don't like him, do you?"
"It's not that," she says. "Careful, girl. I just don't care for his policies. He's cut healthcare funds for the poor every year he's been in office. He cut federal funding for AIDS clinics and reinforced anti-gay legislation across the board. He spearheaded a movement to reduce budgets for the arts in public schools. I just wish he cared more about people and less about winning every argument." Her father doesn't say anything. Gwendy shrugs.
"What can I say? He's just a muggle, Dad."
"What's a muggle?" he asks. Mrs. Peterson touches his arm.
"From Harry Potter, dear."
He looks around the table.
"Harry who?"
This time his wife smacks him on the arm.
"Oh, stop it, you smart aleck."
They all crack up laughing.
"Had you going for a minute," he says, winking.
For the next several hours, Gwendy relaxes, and the button box hardly crosses her mind. There's one brief moment when she's standing at the kitchen window overlooking the backyard, and she spots the old oak tree towering in the distance and remembers once hiding the box in a small crevice at the base of its thick trunk. But the memory is gone from her head as quickly as it arrives. And within seconds, she's back in the den watching Miracle on 34th Street and working on a crossword puzzle with her father. Initially occurred when anti-independence militants launched an attack on a crowd of unarmed civilians. An expression of grim sincerity is etched on the Channel 5 newscaster's face as the banner headline reading "Breaking News, Crisis in Timor" scrawls across the bottom of the screen. "There are early reports of violence and bloodshed spreading throughout the countryside. The worst of the fighting centered in the capital city of Dili. The fighting erupted after a majority of the island's eligible voters chose independence from Indonesia. Over 200 civilian casualties have already been reported, with that number expected to rise." Gwendy sits at the foot of the bed, dressed in a long flannel nightgown, the button box propped up on a pillow beside her, its twin rows of multicolored buttons looking like teeth in the glow of the television. The anchorman promises more breaking news from Timor just as soon as it becomes available, and then Channel 5 goes to commercial. At first, Gwendy doesn't move, doesn't even seem to breathe, and then she turns to the box,
and in an odd, toneless voice says, "Curiosity killed the cat." She uses her pinky to pull the lever on the right side of the box. A narrow wooden shelf slides out from the center with a silver dollar on it. Gwendy picks up the shiny coin and, without looking at it, places it beside her on the bed. The shelf slides back in without a sound. "But satisfaction brought it back," she recites in that same odd voice, and pulls the other lever. The wooden tray slides out again, this time dispensing a tiny piece of chocolate in the shape of a horse. She picks up the chocolate with two steady fingers and looks at it with amazed wonder. Lifting it to her face, she closes her eyes and breathes in the sweet, otherworldly aroma. Her eyes open lazily and gaze at the chocolate with a look of naked desire. She licks her lips as they begin to part. And then she's fleeing to the bathroom, hot tears streaming from her eyes and flushing the chocolate horse down the toilet. 28. The first person Gwendy sees when she walks into the Castle Rock diner on Sunday morning is Old Man Pilkey, the town's retired postmaster. Hank Pilkey is going on 90 years old and has a glass left eye as the result of a fly fishing accident. Rumor has it his second wife, Ruth, got drunk on moonshine and caused the injury while they were honeymooning in Nova Scotia. When Gwendy was young, she was terrified of the old man and dreaded tagging along with her parents to the post office on Saturday mornings. It wasn't that she was spooked or even grossed out by the shiny prosthetic eyeball. She was simply a nervous wreck that she'd go into some kind of weird staring trance and cause the old guy discomfort or even worse, embarrassment. Fortunately, years of practice have helped to ease Gwendy's fears, and when she swings open the diner's front door, a pair of "Have You Seen This Girl?" posters taped to the outside of the thick glass. At a few minutes before 10, an old man Pilkey spots her with a toothless grin, hops down from his stool in front of the long formica counter, and opens his saggy arms in greeting. Gwendy looks him in the eye and hugs him back with genuine affection.
"There's our hometown hero,"
he croaks, gripping her shoulders with bony fingers and holding her at arm's length so he can get a good look at her. Gwendy laughs, and it feels good after the long night she's just had. "How are you, Mr. Pilkey?"
"Fair to middling," he says, easing back onto the stool. "Fair to middling."
"And how's Mrs. Pilkey?"
"Ornery as ever and twice as sweet."
"Fair words to describe the both of you," Gwendy says and gives him a wink. "Enjoy your Sunday, Mr. Pilkey."
"You do the same, young lady. My best to your folks."
Gwendy walks to an empty table by the window, nodding hello to several other townspeople, many of them dressed in church clothes, and sits down. Gazing around the diner, she estimates she knows 2/3 of the people in there, maybe more. She also estimates that maybe half of them voted for her last November. Castle Rock's her hometown, but it's still, and probably always will be, a Republican hotspot.
"I thought that was you."
Gwendy looks up startled. "Jesus, Norris, you scared me."
"Sorry about that," he says. "Whole damn town's on edge."
He gestures to the empty chair.
"Mind if I sit?"
"Please," Gwendy says. The sheriff sits down and adjusts his gun belt on his hip.
"I got your message. Was planning to call you back this morning, but I needed coffee first. Late night."
Norris Ridgwick is 2 years older than Gwendy and has occupied the Castle County Sheriff's Office since taking over for Alan Pangborn in late 1991. Standing a hint over 5'6" and weighing in at an even 150 pounds, wearing his uniform, shoes, and sidearm, the sheriff doesn't make much of a physical impression, but he more than makes up for it by being resourceful and kind. Gwendy has always believed that Norris carries a deep well of sadness within him, most likely due to losing his father when he was just 14 years old and his mother a decade later. Gwendy likes him a lot.
"Why so late?" she asks. "Anything new with the girls?"
The sheriff's eyes wander around the diner. Gwendy follows his gaze and notices many of the other diners have stopped eating and are staring at them.
"Not much," he says, lowering his voice. "We're checking out some leads with the Tomlinson girl, a part-time teacher at her school, a custodian at the dance studio she attended, but neither are exactly what I call prime suspects.
And the Hoffman girl? He shrugs and waves to get a waitress's attention.
That one's even tougher. We got the time frame down to just under 14 minutes. That's how long the brother was out of the house. In those 14 minutes, someone smashed the glass on the back door, entered the house, took Carla Hoffman from her bedroom, and disappeared without a trace.
Without a trace, Gwendy repeats in a whisper. He nods.
Or much of a struggle, evidently. No prints on the door or anywhere inside the house. It snowed that morning, but the kids had a snowball fight in the yard, so it was a mess. No chance of boot or footprints. Could have come by car, but none of the neighbors saw or heard anything.
Anything coming in on the tip line, she asks. I saw the Hoffmans put up a reward.
Bunch of calls, but only a handful worth following up on, which we're doing.
Nothing else?
The sheriff shrugs. We're trying our damnedest to find a connection between the two girls, but so far, it's not there. They live in different neighborhoods, attend different schools, have different hair color, body types, hobbies. No sign that they knew each other or had close mutual friends. Neither has a boyfriend or has ever been in any kind of trouble.
What are the chances the two disappearances aren't related?
Doubtful.
What's your gut say?
My gut says I need coffee.
He glances around for the waitress again. Gwendy gives him an irritated look.
What? He asks. You believe in all that gut instinct, mumbo jumbo?
I do, she says. The sheriff pulls in a deep breath, lets it out. He glances out the window before meeting Gwendy's eyes again.
A lot of weird shit has happened in the Rock over the years, you know that. The big fire in 91, boogeyman Frank Dodd murdering those folks, Sheriff Bannerman and all those other men getting killed by that rabid St. Bernard, hell, even the suicide stairs. You believe it was an earthquake that knocked them down? I got a bridge to sell you.
Gwendy sits there and offers up her best poker face, an expression she's nearly perfected after less than a year in Washington, D.C.
I hope to hell I'm wrong, he says, sighing heavily. But I have a feeling we're never going to see those girls again. Not alive, anyway.
29. After breakfast, Gwendy strolls across the street to Book Nook and picks up the Sunday editions of both the New York Times and the Washington Post. The owner of the bookstore, a stylish woman in her mid-50s, named Grace Featherstone, greets her with a hug and several minutes of colorfully worded grievances relating to President Hamlin. Gwendy stands at the counter, unable to get a word in, nodding enthusiastically. When the older woman finally takes a breath, Gwendy pays for the newspapers and a pack of mints. Then she goes outside and sits in her car, scanning both publications for news about Timor, or more importantly, photographs from Timor. Several years earlier, Ryan was sent to Brazil to help cover a story about a number of seaside villages that had been taken over and eventually destroyed by a local drug lord. He spent 3 weeks hiding in the jungle with armed guerrillas, unable to contact home in any fashion. During this time, the only way Gwendy was able to confirm Ryan's safety was by locating his photo credits in the daily newspapers and a handful of websites on the internet. Ever since, in similarly trying times, this method became Gwendy's safety net of last resort. Just seeing Ryan's name printed in tiny type next to one of his photographs was enough to calm her heart for the next day or two until the next photo made an appearance. Gwendy checks and double-checks both papers, her fingertips growing dark with smudged ink, the passenger seat and dashboard disappearing beneath a mountain of loose pages and advertising circulars, but doesn't find any photographs. Each newspaper carries a brief article, but they're buried on inside pages and are mostly rehashes of old stories. The Associated Press recently reported online that a United Nations force consisting of mainly Australian Defense Force personnel was deployed to East Timor to establish and maintain peace. After that, not much else was known. 30. Gwendy spends the majority of Sunday afternoon Christmas shopping with her mom. Their first stop is the Walmart, where Gwendy picks up a couple of jigsaw puzzles for her father, and Mrs. Peterson snatches the last remaining Sony Walkman on the shelf for Blanche Goff, her longtime neighbor and friend, to use on her morning strolls around the high school track. Gwendy's cell phone rings as they're walking to the parking lot. It's her father checking in to see how Mom is faring. Gwendy gives her mother a look and tells him everything's fine and promises to keep an eye on her. Before she hangs up, Mrs. Peterson grabs the phone from her daughter's hand and says, "Just watch your football games and leave us alone, you old nag." The two of them climb into the Subaru, stashing their bags in the back seat and giggling like a couple of teenagers. The truth is, Gwendy has been keeping close tabs on her mother, and so far she's delighted with what she's seen. Mrs. Peterson is still a bit frail, and she's definitely slower on her feet, but all that's to be expected after everything she's been through. More important, to Gwendy at least, is the fact that her mother's cheery attitude and whip-smart sense of humor are back, not to mention that sweet smile of hers. There'd been barely a glimpse of those things during the 8 weeks of chemotherapy. After Walmart, the two women grab a light lunch at the Cracker Barrel and head to the mall out on Route 119. The two-story shopping mall is as crowded and noisy as a Friday night football game. It seems like half of Castle Rock's teenage population is there that afternoon. But they don't let it take away from their fun. Gwendy and her mom spend the next couple of hours knocking off the final items on their gift lists, eating double-scoop ice cream cones while people watching in the food court, and singing along to the never-ending selection of Christmas carols playing over the mall's sound system. At their final stop of the day, Gwendy leaves her mom sitting on a bench outside of Bart's Sporting Goods and goes inside to purchase a rain suit for Ryan to wear kayaking. It was his only gift request before he left, and she's determined to have it waiting for him under the tree. Gwendy is stuffing the credit card receipt into her bag and not looking where she's going when she bumps into another shopper on her way out of the store. "I'm so sorry," Gwendy says, and then looks up and sees who it is. "Oh my God, Bridget!" The tall blonde woman laughs and picks up the shopping bag that was jostled from her hand. "Same old Gwendy, always running somewhere." Bridget Desjardins was 2 years ahead of Gwendy at Castle Rock High. Back in those days, they ran indoor track together and spent a lot of time at each other's houses. "I haven't seen you since, what, the 4th of July parade?" Gwendy asks, giving her friend a hug. "You ran into me that day, too." Gwendy covers her mouth. "Oh my God, you're right, I did. I'm so sorry." Gwendy had knocked a glass of lemonade right out of Bridget's hand and all over her brand new sundress. "I never used to be so darn clumsy, but I think I'm making up for lost time these past few years." "That's okay, Gwen," says Bridget, laughing. "I think I know a way you can make it up to me." "Tell me." Bridget raises her eyebrows. "Well, you probably haven't heard, but I was elected president of the PTA in September." "That's terrific," Gwendy says with sincere admiration. "Congratulations." "Oh, whatever," Bridget rolls her eyes and smiles. "Miss Big Shot Senator. I'm not a... Anywho, I'm in charge of the New Year's Eve celebration this year, weather permitting. We're holding it outside in the common, and I was wondering..." Gwendy doesn't say anything. She can guess what's coming next. "If you might stop by and say a few words..." One of her mother's favorite sayings flits through her mind. "Don't choose the easy thing to do. Choose the right thing to do." "It would only be for 3 or 4 minutes, but I understand if you can or don't want to, or you already have other..." Gwendy places a hand on her old friend's shoulder. "I'd be happy to." Bridget squeals and throws her arms around Gwendy. "Thank you, thank you. You have no idea what this means to me." "Just make sure you're not holding a mug of hot chocolate when you see me coming." Bridget giggles, relaxing her bear hug. "Deal. I'll give you a call next week so you can tell me when and where to show up."
"Perfect. Thank you again so much."
She starts walking away and then turns back.
"A very Merry Christmas to you and your family."
"Merry Christmas. I'm glad I ran into you." Gwendy turns and starts wading through the crowded promenade. Halfway to the bench where she'd left her mom, Mrs. Peterson comes into view, and Gwendy raises a hand to wave, but she never gets that far. Her mother isn't alone. A stab of terror piercing her chest, Gwendy starts pushing her way through the crowd. 31. "Who was that?" Gwendy nearly shouts, frantically scanning the throngs of shoppers behind the bench. "Who were you just talking to?" Mrs. Peterson looks up in surprise. "What? What's wrong?" "The man with the black hat, the one you were just talking to. Did you know him?"
"No. He said he's visiting with friends in town. He asked me a couple of questions and went on his way."
"What friends?"
"I didn't ask him that," Mrs. Peterson says. "What's going on, Gwen?"
Up on her tiptoes now, still searching the crowd. "What kind of questions did he ask?"
"Well, let me think. He asked how I liked it here in Castle Rock. I told him I'd lived here my entire life, that it was home."
"What else?"
"He wanted to know if I could recommend a good restaurant for dinner. He said he hadn't had a decent hot meal in weeks and he was very hungry, which I thought was rather odd considering how nicely he was dressed."
"What else?"
"That was it. It was a very brief conversation."
"What did he look like? Can you describe him?"
"He was," she thinks for a moment, "tall and thin and probably about your age. I think he had blue eyes."
Mrs. Peterson stands and picks up her shopping bags from the bench. "Now, are you going to tell me what's going on, or do I have to start worrying about you, too?" Thinking fast, Gwendy looks at her mom with that same blank poker face. "There's a reporter who's been bothering me these past few weeks. He's persistent and not a very nice man. For a minute, I was afraid he followed me all the way up here from D.C.
"Oh, dear," Mrs. Peterson says, and Gwendy immediately feels horrible for lying to her. "This gentleman seemed very kind, but I guess you can never really tell, can you?"
Gwendy gives her a quick nod.
"It's getting harder and harder, that's for sure."
32. The cold air feels good in Gwendy's lungs, and the burn in her legs is like catching up with an old friend. After dropping her mom at the house, she wanted nothing more than to drive home to the condo and head straight upstairs to bed. But her brain had other ideas, especially after the scare she experienced at the mall. She follows Pleasant Road down the winding hill, the street well lit and cheery with yard after yard of twinkling Christmas lights, until it runs into Route 117. The road grows darker here, just the occasional pole lamp casting dim globes of sickly yellow light onto the ground below. And she picks up her pace, heading for the old covered bridge that stretches across the Bowie Stream. Running is usually just as much an act of meditation for Gwendy as it is a form of exercise. On those rare bad weather days when she's forced to work out on the treadmill or Stairmaster at the YMCA, she often listens to music on her Sony Walkman, usually something upbeat and peppy like Britney Spears or the Backstreet Boys, a fact Ryan never fails to give her grief about. But during her outside jaunts, she almost always prefers to run in silence. Just her and her innermost thoughts. The familiar sounds of the city or the countryside, and the rhythmic slap of her shoes punishing the asphalt. Tonight, she's thinking about her husband. Of course, she's worried about him, and anxious he won't make it home in time for Christmas. But she knows those concerns are out of her control and even a little bit selfish. Ryan has a job to do. A sometimes dangerous job he loves with all his heart, and she supports that passion unconditionally as he does hers. It's part of what makes them work so well together. On a daily basis, they may prefer the simplicity of each other's company, a walk in the woods, a game of gin rummy at the kitchen table, a late-night double feature at the drive-in, to crowded black-tie events and fancy art openings. But when work calls, they each know the drill. True passion is almost always accompanied by sacrifice. So why all the angst this time? Gwendy wonders as she approaches the old bridge. It's not like this is their first rodeo. Ryan's gone away on dozens of other assignments since they've been together. A steady stream of likely answers trickles through her mind as she runs. It's because of the holidays. It's because her mother is still recovering from a life-altering illness. It's because the button box is back in her life, and she doesn't have a clue what to do with it. Gwendy considers the question a little longer, then checks off all of the above and picks up her stride, focusing on the road ahead. The streetlight attached to the covered bridge's outer planking is dark, most likely having served as target practice for some bored townie with a .22 rifle. The entrance looms ahead like a dark, hungry mouth, but Gwendy doesn't break pace. She glides into the heart of the pitch-dark tunnel, rapid footsteps echoing around her, reminding her, just as they did when she was a little girl, of the old fairy tale about the evil troll living under the bridge. "It's just a story," she tells herself, pumping her arms. "Nothing's going to reach out and grab you. Nothing's going to leap down from the rafters and..." She's a few yards away from reaching the exit when she hears a noise in the darkness behind her, a furtive scratching like claws scrambling across pavement. A finger of dread tickles the length of her spine. She doesn't want to turn and look, but she can't help herself. A pair of close-set eyes, unblinking and coal red, watches her from deep within the shadows. Gwendy feels her legs begin to falter and wills them to keep moving, her breath coming fast and ragged. By the time she looks away, she's clear of the bridge and back under the stars on Route 117. "Probably just a stupid raccoon," Gwendy thinks, sidestepping around a pothole in the road. Pulling cool air deeply into her lungs, she keeps running, a little faster now, and doesn't look back.